Buddy, here we are. I wanted to welcome everybody. This is actually our last lecture in our series on American material culture, sponsored by the American and New England Studies program. I should say, though, that while this is the last lecture, it is not our very last event, because there's still one important event to come, which is the Conference on Material Culture that was organized by the Graduate Student Association in the American Studies program. The conference is called Beyond Production and Consumption, Refining American Material Culture Studies. It's happening on Saturday, March 23rd, here at, I think it's 147 Bay State. Does that sound right? Yeah, 147 Bay State. You can check our website for more details on this, and might as well check our website because why not? There's other information on there, too. But there is a great lineup of speakers for that conference. There's also a keynote address by Professor Ned Cook from Yale. So that's an exciting day of events. I'm Nina Silber. Last time I introduced myself, I said I'm the new director of American Studies. Now I feel like I'm the old director of American Studies. So not because I've aged or anything, but So I'm the director of the American and New England Studies program, and I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for this lecture. Marie Abbe is assistant professor of musicology and ethnomusicology here at Boston University. She is multi-talented. I know that from reading all about her now. She plays the accordion and the piano. She's in a band that's been written about in the New York Times and in Rolling Stone. How many of you can say that? She is a scholar, of course, too.
What's the name of the band?
Dibble Band. It's an Ethiopian.
Okay. And she is currently researching a book on Chindonya. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Chindonya, which is a popular musical practice in Japan. And she also co-produced an NPR radio documentary, which was called Squeezebox Stories, and which told the stories from California immigration history using the accordion as a common trope. And so that is what she's going to talk to us about today, squeeze box stories. So please join me in welcoming Marie Abbe.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be able to share my work with you. And this is, I think, officially the first time I get to really be interacting with students and faculty members from American and New England Studies programs. I'm very excited about this. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah.
And this it's also exciting because this was really my project specifically for the general public, so I haven't been able to bring this to the academic community, so I'm curious to see how this goes and what your reactions will be. And I know this is a conversation series. I like that it's a conversation series instead of lecture series. And I'm hoping that there will be a lively conversation afterwards. But I have prepared a paper that I'll be reading. And there will be, but don't worry, there will be some music interspersed throughout. So I'd like to start by playing an excerpt, or rather a billboard, sort of a one-minute introduction to the documentary. Squeezebox Stories.
I'm Marco Werman of PRI's The World. Welcome to Squeezebox Stories, a musical and social history of the accordion. In the next hour, we'll visit Zydeco dance halls and Mexican Norteño clubs, punk rock apprentices and Arabic master musicians, all to discover what's behind the surprisingly wide appeal of this ultimate people's instrument.
For the accordion, that's the only instrument you hug. It becomes part of your body. When I carry my accordion, all my shyness goes away.
The accordion, it's not just that it's been in different hands or played differently by different people, it's been the meeting place, it's been the crossroads.
And man, that sound just hits you.
Join us for a musical journey with the accordion. First, this news.
So I produced this documentary in collaboration with a radio journalist, Julie Kane. And this is a 60-minute documentary telling four different stories about immigration histories in California using the accordion as a common trope. And as our commentator of the documentary you just heard, and also an American history and sociology professor, George Lipsitz, notes, the accordion is one of the first global instruments. And furthermore, it's more than just a musical instrument. It's an instrument of socialization, instrument of upward mobility, and instrument of assimilation. And conceived as such, accordion became a powerful trope for us that enabled us to demonstrate how the immigration histories and memories shift in discourses of ethnic identities in the United States and cultural imaginaries of their sense of belonging became articulated at different conjunctures. So I'd like to tell you what the four stories are very briefly, and then I'll be focusing on one of the stories. The first stop on our accordion journey is at an accordion repair shop in San Francisco, where the accordion has been recognized as the city's official instrument.
Wow!
The story profiles an unusual relationship between Vince Cirelli on the right, an Italian-American accordion repairman in his 90s, and Skylar Fell on the left, a woman in her early 30s who's apprenticing with him to learn the craft. Mm. Tattooed, pierced, and part of the steampunk DIY Burning Man scene, Fell owns her own accordion repair shop in San Francisco, where she says, quote, "Accordion revolution is happening among people of all ages." This is a story about the history of Italian immigration to California, which gave rise to San Francisco becoming the center of accordion manufacturing in the United States at the turn of the century, 19-teens. And about the new generation of accordion enthusiasts, many of whom are women, and who are also helping bring in the accordion back out of the closet or attic. And about how Cirelli and Fell's passion in their work tend into the beauty and complexity of the instrument bridges generations. After this story, we take a quick historical detour to learn about the rise and the fall of accordion's popularity in the 20th century America. So we visit the world of Lawrence Welk, right there, whose widely popular TV show Lawrence Welk Show shaped the American popular soundscape during the early to mid-20th century, and find out why accordion ended up in the closet after that. This short segment highlights how accordion at first became a tool for assimilation, a symbol of whiteness, and subsequently a stigmatized object signifying the old Europe. And that statue on the left is at the Lawrence Welk Resort near San Diego. It has its own resort. After this quick interlude, the second squeeze box story takes us to a Zydeco dance party hosted by a church in Richmond, California. Playing the accordion and singing at the center of the makeshift stage is Andre Thierry, who has been playing the instrument since he was a child, and he has a strong memory of being enchanted by the instrument really early on in his childhood. Now in his early 30s, Thierry grew up around Zydeco musicians touring from Louisiana, and his grandmother, Lena Petrie, organized and hosted Zydeco parties to bring together the black Creoles who migrated from Louisiana to California in the 1950s. And there was a lot of shipyard labor demand, so there was a lot of migration there. So this story tells us how Zydeco came to be in Louisiana, how Zydeco traveled all the way across the country to California together with the internal migration of the Creoles, and how this accordion-driven dance music provides a home away from home for them. As one of the dancers says in the documentary, quote, "No matter how far we go, Zydeco brings us home," end quote. And in our third squeeze box story, we hear a style of an accordion music that some of us may not be so familiar with. Meet Elias Lamont, the master performer of the Arabic accordion. Mm-hmm. A native of Lebanon, Elias studied the classical Arabic accordion for 13 years before he emigrated to the United States. We'll visit his accordion classes, learn how the accordion became an important sound in various styles of music in the Middle East, and understand how the accordion isn't always a populist instrument. Mm-hmm. For him, it's an instrument of prestige that requires a lifetime to master. And along the way, we also get a quick lesson on how the Arabic tonal system works and how the accordion must be modified to accommodate the difference. They have all these microtones that are between the white and black keys. So he goes in there and retunes the reeds so he can play the Arabic scales. So unlike other stories in this audio documentary where the accordion brings people of shared heritage together, this story highlights how a single accordionist can bring together people of various backgrounds to build an awareness and appreciation of musical traditions from distant places. And our last...
Excuse me, did you say where he migrated to? Is he also California?
Are they all in California.
Okay.
Yeah. This was funded by California Council for the Humanities.
Oh, okay.
So, California Stories Fund. And our last squeeze box story is from California's Central Valley, a vast agricultural region where many Mexicans immigrate to find work in the fields. The most recent wave of Mexican immigrants to California are mostly indigenous people from the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca, many of whom don't even speak Spanish as their first language, and who are often discriminated against within mainstream Mexican culture for their indigenous heritage. Although the accordion didn't used to be a popular instrument in their home state, some Oaxacan immigrants in Central Valley today are now starting to embrace the accordion, playing their traditional Chilena music in their new home as a way of expressing their regional pride. What's happening is a new emergent accordion music made possible precisely because of immigration. This story gives us a sense of the diversity within Mexican migrant worker communities, who at times are portrayed to be monolithic in the US media. By listening to the Oaxacan musicians' creative endeavors in California, we can learn about the complex dynamics and history among different groups of people in Mexico, and how the accordion can provide a new creative facet for Oaxacan workers to negotiate their sense of self within the Mexican community, within California, and then within the United States. So today's talk, I'd like to first introduce how my documentary project came to be and what it means to center a study around one single musical instrument. Then I'd like to zero in on one of the four stories from the documentary, The Last One, to show ethnographically what it might look like to think through a social life of an instrument. And since this is a conversation series, I'm hoping that we can share our squeeze box stories if we have one, and I'll be also happy to talk about, you know, topics or questions on the intersections of journalism and scholarship, or musical instruments as material culture, or immigration and music. I would be very curious to hear what everybody might have to say about those topics. First, before I launch into this, though, I'm curious, who loves the accordion here? I know you do. Who hates the accordion? It's okay.
How about like?
Who like the accordion? Nice. Okay.
Who's indifferent?
There we go.
It's actually quite rare to find indifferent. Yeah. Yeah. Either love
mostly
or hate.
Mostly love or hate.
It's almost love or hate. Okay.
It's more for me like take it or leave it.
Okay.
If I may share a Mexican joke, is the definition of a gentleman is someone who can play the accordion, but doesn't.
We'll get to accordion jokes shortly. There's so
who many. Knew it was a genre?
And I'm sure some of you already told me, but I'm sure many of you also have stories about the accordions in the attics, or, you know, my uncle plays this, or my grandma played this. Anyway, so the radio documentary was born when I first met my collaborator and radio journalist, Julie Kanan, at a dinner party. finding out that I'm an accordionist, she said, okay, I have to ask, why is the accordion everywhere? While many Americans may associate the accordion with polka or whiteness exclusively, Julie, as an avid fan of vernacular music from around the world, knew that the accordion indeed is a global instrument. Since its inception in Austria in 1829, it has spread throughout the world through the forces of European expansion, colonialism, and migration in the following century. You can find the instrument in places from Madagascar, South Africa, Egypt, Lebanon, Afghanistan, China, both South and North America, all over the place, Western and Eastern Europe, including Scandinavian countries, and beyond. So our dinner conversation led to more exchanges, collaborative research, and eventually winning of a grant that helped us produce this radio documentary. So to produce this documentary, we spent 2 years doing preliminary field work, driving up and down California. We interviewed over 100 people who were accordion people in one way or another. We musicians, fans, and a few haters, repairmen and women, teachers, and festival organizers. It only took us a few months before we started to see various narrative patterns emerging in our exchanges. Some had their bag of accordion jokes ready. before talking about jokes, these are just to give you an idea of how diverse this instrument can be. Yeah. The top left is one of the earliest models, and when it was first invented, it was invented to be a substitute for pipe organs in church in churches and services in Austria and Germany. So the green one so is
Protestant denominations, or
I would think so.
What year is the
1829?
1829 is the first accordion.
Yeah, and then the green one is a button accordion, most commonly found in Mexican music, in South American music. To the right, upper right-hand corner is a Cajun button accordion, single row. So those are all, well, button. And then the right, the bottom right is a French chromatic button accordion. Mm-hmm. And then those two on the bottom, middle and the left, those are piano accordion. And then the one in the middle is from the 1930s, very ornate, mm-hmm. 20s and 30s. It was a novelty instrument in vaudeville circuit. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that was cheaply manufactured for common people yet. It was on, after the 30s and 40s when it became simplified like that. Mm-hmm. And then here are some, you know, accordion jokes. Sure. The left one says, "Welcome to heaven, here's your harp. Welcome to hell, here's your accordion." And then the other one is, "Give me all your cash. I have an accordion and I know how to use it."
Me too.
So those, that was one of the first things people would tell us. Some hated the accordion passionately because it was imposed on them as a child, something that they had to learn in schools. I also heard a few lost accordion stories where people told of painful and unfortunate separations from their instruments, and then the subsequent wondrous and ecstatic reuniting with their beloved object many years later, or sometimes decades later. Many people called it the devil instrument, devil's instrument, an instrument that has magical power to lure certain people. Others had a recurring closet story. Many of the great musicians we met along the way shared with us how they felt this inevitable attraction to the instrument, which was forbidden or supposed to be somebody else's job in the family. As a result, they snuck around, practiced in secrecy, sometimes while hiding in the closet, literally, until they suddenly and finally gained recognition as the passionate and accomplished accordionists. One thing was clear, that this musical instrument, the sturdy material object made of wood and thousands of intricate parts made of metal, beeswax, and deer leather, does something to people. It elicits affective responses, memories, and creative expressions from the users, listeners, and makers. In his recent article, ethnomusicologist Elliot Bates takes on this precise question about the materiality and agency of musical instruments. He asks, "How do we think about a musical instrument as not only central to human social networks, but also as an actor with a kind of agency? Showing how certain musical instruments not only facilitates, prevents, or mediates social interactions, but also creates desire and affect through sounds." Bates draws our attention to the musical instrument's capacity for action. Rather than a study of musical instrument as simply a passive artifact from which sound emanates, Bates calls for a study of social life of musical instruments that examines, quote, "the performative and integrative capacity of things to help make what we call society," end quote. In other words, going beyond the Brownian semiotic mode of analysis of material culture, Bates is advocating for relational analysis of musical instruments as agentful actors within the paradigm that encompasses the full range of possible human, object, divine relations. I find Bates' claim compelling, with some caution. His rather provocative model certainly resonates with many of the stories, narratives, and interactions I witnessed in the course of producing the radio documentary. As I hope my short overview of the beginning of the talk showed, the accordion became more than a metaphorical trope or connective narrative thread. The four stories in the documentary are an ethnographic testament to these active capacities of the instrument in the shaping of social and cultural life in distinct historical and geographical contexts. Particularly, the fourth story about the Oaxacan migrant workers in Central Valley presented a case that prompted me to not only think about the accordion as an embodied symbol of senses of belonging as Mexican-American, and emerging Oaxacan, but also as a force that propelled the emergence of a new transcultural creative practices, enabling some Oaxacan musicians to challenge and negotiate the complex transnational forces that inform their everyday life. So in the next 20 minutes or so, I want to delve more deeply into the last story from the documentary in order to think through the instrument and how the accordion has produced new creative and political possibilities for its performers and listeners among Oaxaca migrant farm workers. And I should add that after producing this radio documentary, last story really compelled me to go back. So I kept going back to do some supplementary field work. So what I'm going to talk about will have some of the story and then a lot of new ideas and information that I gather from that. So I will show you, I will play just at the beginning of this clip.
In many parts of the United States, when you scan the radio, you're very likely going to hear something like this. This is norteño music, and it's a big part of mainstream Mexican culture in the United States. Flashy button accordions are always a centerpiece, and it's what many people from Mexico listen to. The face of Mexican immigration is changing, however, and the music is changing along with it. The latest wave of immigrant farm workers in California are indigenous people from the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca. Many of this most recent wave of immigrants don't even speak Spanish as their first language. Producers Julie Kane and Marie Abe went to California's Central Valley in search of a new kind of accordion music.
So begins the last segment of this fourth story. We chose to end the documentary with a story because we wanted to inform the public radio listeners of the diversity and complex dynamics within the often monolithically conceived population of Mexican immigrants and introduce the creative musical processes we witnessed among the indigenous Oaxacan working in the fields in San Joaquin Valley, California. So just to give you an idea, Oaxaca is one of the southernmost states and that is the Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley, where we went. It's right by Fresno. So both in the United States and Mexico, indigenous Oaxacans find themselves marginalized economically, socially, and politically as migrants and indigenous people. In addition to the well-known obstacles that confront cross-border migrants in the United States, especially those without documentation, indigenous Oaxacans also face entrenched racist attitudes and discrimination from other Mexicans, who mock them for their rural ways, their heavily accented Spanish or inability to speak it, and their low level of education. As Rai Cooter's 2010 collaboration with the Mexican group Los Tigres del Norte raised the profile of norteño music in mainstream US popular imagination that you just heard, the accordion has reaffirmed its status as the musical signifier of not only the genre, but also the Mexican population in the United States at large. For indigenous and mixed-speaking Oaxacans, though, the sound of the accordion is the sound of the North, Northern Mexico, their regional rivals, and by extension, the Spanish-speaking Mexicans in the United States at large. And for the lack of a better word, I refer to them as mainstream Mexicans as opposed to indigenous Mexicans. Recently, however, Oaxacan farm workers in Central Valley have started to embrace this instrument in the interpretation of a Oaxacan traditional music called chilena. And chilena, the beloved dance music of the states of Oaxaca and Guerrero, is believed to have been introduced to Oaxaca by Chilean sailors who came through Oaxaca on their way to seek fortune in the American gold rush. And this is one of the earlier recordings of chilena music. So triplet beats, fairly fast, characterize the genre, which has traditionally been performed on string instruments, such as violin and guitar, which is what you just heard, but never on the accordion. In fact, it was unfathomable to play chilena on the accordion. One of the farm workers, Carlos Mendoza, on the documentary, recalled, when I was 20 and I wanted to play norteño music on the accordion where I'm from in Oaxaca, they almost chased me out of the town. How did this unseemly combination of the Oaxacan traditional genre of chilena and the accordion, sonic signifier of northern Mexico, become possible? What kind of histories and relations during the migration process across the border created conditions in which this unthinkable sounds became audible? Musical practices like Chilena provide a rich platform through which to analyze and theorize the formation of diasporic subjectivity. In this talk, however, I'm less interested in that, in providing a larger narrative about the formation of collective identity among the Oaxacan people. Rather, I'm interested in teasing out the diverse and sometimes conflicting creative, social, and economic aspirations among the Oaxacan farm workers in Central Valley who play and dance to these new renditions of Chilena on the accordion. To do so, I will tell you stories of three actors who play central roles in the emergence of this musical phenomenon: a radio DJ and an activist, an accordionist and a producer, and a Chilena band, all of whom live near Fresno, California. Following the anthropologist Kathleen Stewart's call to tend to cultural poesis, which she defines as the generative moment in which emergent assemblage of things, forces, and sensibilities take on a particular impact and affect, I want to highlight the politics of the emergent within this provisional and yet productive cultural work done by these actors. And to that, following Elliot Bates, the ethnomusicologist I mentioned earlier, I want us to keep in mind that the accordion in itself is part of this assemblage, a central node in this social network of cultural actors. So moving on to the first character. Filemon Lopez came to the United States during the 80s as part of one of the earliest Mixtec migrant waves. So Mixtec is the language and also a particular indigenous group from Oaxaca. Now in his late 60s, he speaks Spanish with a Mixtec accent. In 1995, Lopez started the first and only Mixtec language weekly radio program in the United States called La Hora Mixteca, the Mixtec Hour, in order to, quote, orient and organize Mixtec community and foster indigenous identity, end quote. The show has now grown into a four-hour program broadcast on the U.S.'s only Spanish public radio station, Radio Bilingüe, transmitting from Fresno to locations throughout the U.S. and many parts of Mexico. So that's what his radio station looks like. La Hora Mixteca was a groundbreaking in several ways. For one, under Mexico's ban on the public display of indigenous languages, which lasted until the early 1990s, gaining Mixtec presence on the airwaves was an achievement in itself. Going beyond the politics of recognition, La Hora Mixteca also facilitated communication between migrant workers and their families divided by the border among the border and among fragmented Mixtec-speaking migrant communities in the United States, promoting access to resources and information to seek better housing, employment, and medical support. And it's also a message program. They can send messages to families on both sides of the border. The show also became a central node of network of local Oaxaca musicians, providing opportunities and exposure. One local musician, Carlos Mendoza, attested to this. He said, "Yes, La Hora Mixteca was like a window through which we saw everyone. Not all of us are lucky enough to have been picked, but they give us a chance to play. There is not a musician here in the San Joaquin Valley who doesn't know Filemon Lopez. We all know him." As Lopez's show gained popularity, more requests for Chilena started to come in. But Chilena was danced at home gathering to a live band and had not been recorded much, either in Oaxaca or in the United States at the time, until the last decade or so, I would say. Lopez encouraged local musicians to come in and record Chilena in his studio. And over time, new innovative forms of Chilena music started to appear. As Lopez expressed to me, quote, "La Hora Mixteca was the first firefly of the spark of Chilena music in California," end quote. Now, Chilena dominates the majority of the airtime. When I visited the Radio Bilingüe studio in Fresno during the broadcasting of this show, dozens of requests for Chilena songs came through the phone. And he said, he cried out, "Oh, it has to be Chilena. If I play something else, listeners will call in and complain." Lopez's radio show then produced a significant unintended consequence. It gave rise to the local Chilena scene, and through the heavy airplay on La Hora Mixteca, Chilena gained traction as a sonic emblem of Oaxacan heritage in the United States, along with the sound of the indigenous language. Now I turn to two musicians within this emergent network of Chilean musicians to examine the variety of creative, social, and political aspirations articulated within the cultural poesis of Chilean music and the accordion. So this musician, Carlos Mendoza, he's a multi-instrumentalist, composer, and producer, and he was the first person in the San Joaquin Valley to produce a full-length album of Chilean songs, a radically innovative concept at the time. Mendoza is short and stout, with a broad smile and an easy laugh. He came to California about 25 years ago to work in the fields. Now in his early 50s, he lives in a modest house with his wife and his seven children. He's built a recording studio in his garage, where he's produced seven All Chilena albums, as well as several albums of Norteño music. His innovative first All Chilena album featured the saxophone as the melody instrument, yet another original move. Although it met with some criticism at first, the album became a sensation. CDs sold well around the area, and requests for Mendoza's Chilena came in constantly at Laura Mixteca, the radio show. It was not until several years later, in the early 2000s, when Mendoza decided to release another All Chilena album, this time on the accordion. So this is the first all accordion Chilena album. Do have lyrics, but most of them are instrumental on this album. The unusual mix of the accordion and chilena in Mendoza's music is best understood in light of his biography. Like many Oaxacan farm workers, Mendoza has migrated in search of work most of his life, first within Mexico and later in the United States. And that is it's the field, grapevine field, right by his house. Although born to Oaxacan parents, Mendoza does not speak Mixtec, as he grew up migrating through various northwestern regions of Mexico while his parents worked. Mendoza grew up listening to the accordion while his parents listened to chilena with longing for their home state. By the time he and his brothers formed a band when he was 8, the natural choice of music was Norteño music, not chilena, because they were so much in the north. After arriving in the United States in the late 1980s, Mendoza spent a decade gigging at the end of long hours in the field, playing Norteño music for non-Oaxacan Mexicans, mainstream Mexicans who speak Spanish, under the group name Real del Norte, so really just the Norteño music. A shift happened gradually, however, in the past 10 years. As his longing for Oaxaca and regional pride grew stronger, Mendoza became committed to reinterpreting and producing chilena music under the moniker of Real de Oaxaca, taking pride in his musical promotion of the indigenous Oaxacan identity. For Mendoza, whose sense of Oaxacan heritage is grounded in the constant migrant movement itself, reinterpreting chilena, a genre that is inherently migrant from Chile to Oaxaca to California, with the accordion was a creative process in which he musically negotiated and articulated the complex sense of belonging and longing as a migrant worker living in the new land. The success of Mendoza's innovative reinterpretations of Chilena music has allowed him to retire from the field, and now he makes his living as a home studio recording engineer, producing during the weekdays while performing at parties and venues on weekends. Mendoza recognizes this, quote, "And we do it so they'll buy it too. Because music doesn't live just by grace, we have to earn enough for our hamburgers. We don't have the fortune to be famous, but if we eat a piece of bread or drink a soda, I owe all of it to music." End quote. The emergent formation of newly reinterpreted Chilena then allowed Mendoza to materialize both his creative and economic aspirations, while asserting his renewed pride in Oaxacan heritage in the face of discriminatory social perception he has endured in decades of working in the fields in California. But not all Chilena musicians who followed suit had the same view of the accordion in Chilena music, nor did they achieve similar success. So this is the third band, Los Yuquinos. A family band consisting of brothers and nephews, Los Yuquinos are of a different generation than Lopez and Mendoza. Mostly in their mid-20s and early 30s, the band members arrived in the Central Valley only 6 years ago, from the Oaxacan village Yucuchimi de Ocampo. Farm workers by day and gigging musicians by night, Los Yuquinos play a variety of gigs, from mainstream Mexican nightclubs to Oaxacan family functions. Mendoza has been producing Los Yuquinos' Chilena albums in the past few years, and they have been getting a lot of airtime on La Hora Mixteca, and I'll play you their song, one example of their Chilena. Heard Los Yuquinos in February of 2009 at the nightclub Aldo's in Fresno. That's where it was. Inside, a big dance floor was surrounded by shiny mirrors, red lights, and the reflections of a spinning disco ball. It was a Saturday night, and people were there to dance. The women wore high heels and short skirts. Almost all men wore cowboy hats, perfect jeans, and dressy cowboy boots with very pointy toes. They're catering to the crowd of predominantly middle-class Mexicans, mainstream Mexicans. Los Yuquinos performed a primarily norteño repertoire. The accordion was front and center, its red and green bellows expanding and contracting rapidly, rhinestones glittering under the flashing lights. Unlike Mendoza, whose constant migrations within Mexico exposed him to norteño music early in his life, Los Yuquinos came directly from their village in Oaxaca to California. The accordion wasn't a sound inherent to their migrant experiences. Rather, it was a sound of mainstream Mexico in the United States, and they chose to embrace it strategically. Los Yuquinos picked up the accordion and norteño repertoire to expand their gigging opportunities after arriving in California. At one point during the set, conscious of our presence, this, you know, gringo and China radio journalist with the microphones, the band announced they would perform a Chilena song, sung in Mixteco, their own native language. But this was not a Oaxacan crowd, as I said. Perhaps not familiar with the Mixteco language or the dance style to go with the fast triplet feel of Chilena music, the crowd stayed seated and silent for the song. It was not until Los Yuquinos switched back to the norteño set that couples got up to dance. Hands on waist, cowboy boots tapping, high heels twirling, and the jumpy two-step. The norteño club event highlighted this sort of awkward silent moment, highlighted the demarcation between the Oaxacan field workers and the mainstream Mexican middle-class crowd at Aldo's, for whom the unfamiliar beats of Chilena and Mixteco language embodied both class and ethnic difference. While Los Yuquinos' gig at Aldo's shows Chilena as a potential sonic marker of difference, Chilena on the accordion has also given rise to an unexpected alliance among field workers from various regions in Mexico. Fast forward 2 years, on my most recent visit back in Fresno in September 2011, so this is one of my follow-up visits, Los Yuquinos was playing quite a different gig. So that was still at Aldo's, but that was actually at Aldo's also. That was 2011. Patricia Vasquez, who you just saw in this, that's him. The 25-year-old accordionist of Los Yuquinos organized a dance party for the local farmers in the open-air community space behind a humble Oaxacan family home on the outskirts of Fresno. It was a fundraising event where the proceeds were to be donated to the local church in their hometown village in Oaxaca. Los Chiquinos opened the night to be followed by three more bands playing an assortment of chilena, norteño, cumbia, and other genres. Around 180 people were in attendance, the majority of whom were men, from teenagers to those in their 60s. Homemade pozole and tamales were served, and as the night progressed, dozens of empty beer cans filled the tabletops, along with cut limes and salt. And tequila. Vasquez told me they were all field workers, many from Oaxaca, but also from other regions, including Guerrero, Sinaloa, and Michoacan. Bands spoke of the crowd in Spanish, spoke to the crowd in Spanish throughout the night instead of Mixtec, and gave a shout out to Mexican states represented in the crowd by creating a call and response during their performances, like raise your hands if you're from Oaxaca, from Michoacan, etc. What we witnessed was quite the opposite of the club event at Aldo's. Whenever the band switched from norteño, cumbia, or another dance song to chilena, a score of people got up to the floor and danced. Chilena isn't a couple's dance. Dancers are scattered across the dance floor, digging the heels into the dirt ground with a rhythmic bounce in their knees. And chilena beats and accordion sounds got people dancing, not just Oaxacans.